Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the 2-Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Welcome to Raw Wine, New York 2022, and welcome to our Speaker's Corner. I'm Sam Van Ruby from the Grape Nation podcast on the Heritage Radio Network. Our guest today is Vladimir Magula from Magula Family Winery Estate in Slovakia. He'll tell you specifically where it is. It's not a huge country. Vladimir is going to talk about the winery. We're going to talk about the Slovakian natural wine scene. We also have 4 of Vladimir's wines here, and we will taste them throughout the talk, and Vladimir will get into them. We'll take questions at any point, if it makes sense, certainly during the tastings. And let's get started. So Vladimir, I think to give everyone some context, I think it would be great if you spent time talking about all these things wrapped in one, which is the winery, the family, the history. I mean, it's rich, but it's young. You know, it's technically 3 generations. So let's, you know, hear about that, and then we'll start, you know, tasting wines.
Thank you, Sam. Hello, everyone. I'm Vlad. It's a privilege to be here, and thank you very much for coming, for taking the time. I hope you will find this interesting and hopefully also pleasurable in terms of tasting. Maybe before we dig in, even though as I start to speak, feel free to start tasting the first wine, I will try to take you through some of the context and stories and the facts in between the wines. It's also why I chose the specific selection today. But to give you just basic intro, first of all, some basic intro for me. Any of you have tasted any wine from Slovakia before? How many people maybe? Quite a lot. Amazing. Any of you have ever tasted Magula wine before? Not so many, but some. Great. Hopefully it will be an addition to your portfolio of flavors after today. So when we're talking about wine from our region, it is very, very much connected to the history and political context of Central Eastern Europe. Many people do not realize that we've been growing wine since the Roman, at least, and probably since the Celtic times before actually start of our, before 0 AD. So it has a long history. Slovakia used to be a part of Austrian Empire, the Habsburg Empire. So our winemaking culture is very, very connected to that. And also the grape varieties that we are growing are generally found in the countries of the former Habsburg Empire, whether it is Austria, Czech Republic, Slovakia, Hungary, or some of the border regions of Slovenia, Northern Italy, and Croatia. And I may introduce you to the first wine as an example of that, because that is a blend of three white grapes. Half of it is Grüne Veltlina, which is the most planted white grape in Slovakia. 30% is Welschriesling and 20% Gewurztraminer. We call this wine Oranžový vlk, which translates as the orange wolf. If you look at the bottle, there is a painting of a wolf on it, done by my sister-in-law. And we have a lot of wolf motifs in our wine, and it is because of the name of our terroir. Our farm, where we not only grow grapes, but also have a chestnut orchard, my wife, she has some horses, and we have a lot of farm animals too, is located in western Slovakia on a hill that is between two valleys. One of the valleys is called Valley of the Roses, and on the other side, we have a place that is called Valley of the Wolves. And our farm is in between those two powerful concepts, and actually there used to be a monastery on the site where our winery is at the moment, so it's really like a very special and powerful place. And we love to kind of draw upon the concepts of those places a lot in the wines, especially with the wolves, because we love the wolves for as a spirit animal, you know, of independence and power and a bit of wildness too. This wine I chose also because it's the only whitish thing that I have available. And although Slovakia is mainly planted with white grape varieties, our microterroir is specifically known for its red wines. It is because it is a place where we have very little rainfall. The literal translation of name of our village translates as dry in English. So we are part of the biggest winemaking area in Slovakia, which is called Malokarpatska, small Carpathian winemaking area. And that is on the slopes of small Carpathian mountains. They go from Bratislava. Bratislava is on the border of Austria, Hungary, and Czech Republic. Parts of Bratislava are bordering each of those three countries. So it's really like a capital that is in the very corner of our country on the River Danube. And from there, the small Carpathian mountains start to go northeast. Our village contrasted Slovakia, maybe to come back to the context of entire country. We have several winemaking areas. Each is very different. There is Malokarpatská in the west, Južnoslovenská, which means South Slovakian in the south. That is typical for deep, strong wines. Then there is the most famous one is in very east of Slovakia, which is Tokaj. It's Slovakian part of Tokaj. There is 600 hectares of Tokaj appellation, like the historic, it used to be one country in the past. So when the appellation of Tokaj was created, it was one country. Now 600 hectares is in Slovakia. Then there is Nitrianska Vinohradnická oblast. That's around the city of Nitra, a little north from the southern Slovakia. And the last one is central Slovakia, and that just borders Nitrianska. All the wine is grown in southern half of the country. The northern part is mountainous and generally not very suitable for growing wine, although it's changing a little bit with the change of climate, of course. To give you the idea where our country is located, in terms of latitude, it is more or less halfway between Alsace, between Bourgogne and Alsace. So a little northern from Burgundy and a little bit south from Alsace. And it is a continental climate, so we have really hot and dry summers and quite cold winters, although they are not as cold as they used to be. And each of the winemaking areas is specific in terms of soil, even though total area of all Slovakian vineyards is just little less than 10,000 hectares, which is less than the entire Alsace, so it's not a big winemaking country. But there is a lot of diversity. We also have a very large amount of grape varieties, and it's a bit challenging to understand all of that, but we love them all, and it's difficult for us just to focus on a few, because all of them have their specific place in our culture and in our hearts. Also in my farm, we have more than 10 grapes that we grow, but I'm trying to combine some in wines like Oranžový vlk so that it's not so confusing, and also the blends work beautifully. When you taste this wine, I have one story that is very representative of a lot of things that we do and how we approach winemaking. I had the pleasure to attend the Speaker's Corner before with Harold from Chateau Le Puy, and I realized it was amazing. Those of you who were here, you know. And I realized the vast difference between a family like this unique winery presents, having 400 years of continuous history and vast amount of experience to draw upon. In Slovakia, even though I said we've been making wine for more than 2,000 years now, the continuity has not been kept. It's not only because the 40 years of communism that we experienced in the second half of 20th century, but also because it's a region that has been ransacked by the raids of Turks and Tatars and all those nations who were invading the region and killing off the people who were living there. So it's been a tough spot for existence. And also, it's one of the reasons why, for instance, in Malokarpatska, all of the traditional winemaking families, they were German settlers. They were not of local ethnicity. If you look at the old names of the vineyards in Malokarpatska, all the names of the vineyards are in German, not in Slovak language. Old name of my village was Dürmbach, which means a dry creek. So it's also all very much connected to the history and cultural evolution of the region. But the largest determinant of our current situation is the fact we had the 40 years of communism. We are very proud to say that I am the fourth generation of a winemaker in our family estate, but that is like a huge overstretch of what it really means, because the winery was started in 1930s by my great-grandfather, who unfortunately died quite young and had three daughters. But what was amazing, two of those daughters were taking over the winery in the end of 1940s. It was my grandmother, who later went on to study law, and her sister, she studied agriculture, and they were about to run the winery further on. But then the communists took over power in our country, which unfortunately, among many other things, meant that land was taken away from the people, and private enterprise was prohibited. So for 40 years, there was no Magula winery and none of private business at all. And also the continuity of families, the learning from the generations, this disappeared. And we are now 30 years after we got rid of the commies. Yeah, in 1989, we had the Velvet Revolution, which was part of the political changes in entire Central Eastern Europe. And still, we are kind of realizing very painfully that it's now almost as long as we have been under the rule of the communists, and still the natural structure of the society has not been restored. You can see it in many aspects of life. I don't want to go to too much detail, but it's a long time since, and still we're struggling in many respects. And it's a very, for me, it's a very interesting position to be as a part of family business, because it is a micro world where you kind of try to restore the natural balance there might have existed before. So the two generations were my great-grandfather and my grandma for maybe 2 or 3 years. Then nothing was happening for a long, long time. And then after the fall of communism, the land was returned to the original families, either the owners or their descendants. And in such way, the plot where my grandfather had the vineyard was returned to my family, to my grandma. And she proceeded to pass it on my father in 2005. And then after that, we have decided with my parents and my wife that we will replant the plot with the vineyard, and we will start to make wine again. So even though it's a fourth generation, our knowledge to draw upon is more or less, I would say, 13 years of experience. So we are a baby winery at the moment, which has some advantages and some disadvantages. One of the biggest advantages is that we do not have any preconceptions and any myths ingrained in our brains and in our family culture, which happens quite often in the traditional family. So we do not have the knowledge and experience, but at the same time, we have a clean slate that allowed us to experiment quite extravagantly sometimes. And at the same time, it allowed us to embrace the concept of natural wine that we were fortunate enough to discover very early on our winemaking journey. And it made perfect sense to us. And fortunately, we did not have the idea that it is going, like many of the very good traditional winemakers believe, it's a not possible way of doing things, because that's what they have been taught the entire life. So that was a big advantage, that we could just dive in after visiting a now iconic Slovakian winemaker, which is Streko 1075. So those who knew Slovak wine probably came across that. That was the first time I tasted a wine that was made. We did not know the term natural wine at that time yet, but it was they called it wine faithful to the nature. That was the
that's a new
the
one.
Term they were coining. And it was beautiful. And more or less for me, I never looked back after tasting that wine.
So you started planting in 07, right? Is that about when?
I beg pardon?
Sorry. You started planting the vines in 2007?
Yes, in 2007. I would go to story of that maybe with the next samples. Maybe one thing to tell about this wine. It's the only wine that we are making without any addition of sulfites. So all the wines are made quite strictly naturally. We farm biodynamically in our vineyards. We've been organic from almost the very beginning, from the year 2012. But for me, the greatest challenge is to make wine that is really pure grape juice that just ferments and is transformed into the bottle in a pure form that is accessible to drink and brings joy to the person that drinks it. I very strongly believe that that's like the most challenging part of the winemaking mission, is to capture the essence of life in the vineyard, not to destroy it first of all in the vineyard. So the vineyard must be full of life and strong by itself. And then the challenge for the winemaker is not to destroy that strength of life that is brought to the cellar. And of course, the more one tries to control the process and to intervene or to use substances that intervene with the natural aging and transformation of the grape juice to the wine, I think the more risky it is and the more probable it is that the essence of life, the thing that actually makes wine much more than just an alcoholic beverage with some flavor profile, that is taken away. Therefore, even though I'm using sulfur as the only additive in all of my wines except for this one, I'm looking into the zero added sulfite style of winemaking as a vision that makes sense to me philosophically and also practically, because I think when the wine is properly made, it should be able to be strong and stable and pure without faults, even without the use of sulfite. So it's a big topic for me and for our family internally. We're just scared we don't have the balls to do it with some of the other wines, even though the bottles that we bottle for ourselves, they are beautiful. But I...
So people can imagine, visualize, talk about the vineyards, vineyard practices. Let's talk about, you know, the soils you're dealing with, you know, get into the climate again a little. And, you know, what you're doing out there, obviously, you know, hand picking and all of that. So, you know, take us through before the wine comes into the cellar.
Maybe to talk about the vineyards, we can also look at the second sample, because that is very connected to our evolution of wine growing and planting the vineyards. We have some old vineyards too, because as we got back the plot for which we planted the vineyard of the last two samples, then we started to purchase also some land with old vineyards, and that is together creating the farm that we have now of about 8 hectares. Like I said, we are a cool climate region. The soil in our village is loess. And
L-O-E-S-S?
Yeah, that's it.
What is that?
It's a very fine-grained type of soil that originates by blowing of the dust particles. Generally, you have rivers that are flooding in the spring, and in some, I don't know exactly which period of Earth evolution it was happening, but the wind was then blowing those. That soil or the grains of the flooded soil when it dried out, and it created the dunes that are called loess. There are also some remains of the ancient sea in the underground of our soil. So the amount of calc is extremely high, which gives a beautiful acidity to all of the grapes that we have. Whether it's white grapes, and also when it's really late harvest grapes, we always have very high degree of acidity, a lot of acids in the grapes, which is great for aging and generally stability of the wines too. We discussed training of the vines extensively. The traditional training system in our region is called... I think internationally it's called Guyot. We call it Rheinhessen or middle training system. So it's about 60 centimeters tall, and then you have to, from there you prune the vine to have the yearly shoots. The very traditional system is to prune the vines on the head. So you every year you just cut you prune it to the bottom right above the earth, and in some places the training is cordon, you know, high training when the trunk is going about 160 centimeters tall, and then the pruning is taking place at that height. And the yearly shoots, they are not going upwards, but they fall down. They create this, in the end, they create this tunnel.
A pea.
canopy. I think canopy is a roof. Yeah. It's not really a roof. It's like you can pass between. It's important, but it falls. The shoots fall all the way down to the earth.
Wow.
There's a massive area of leaves, which is good for photosynthesis, for creation of the sugar in the grapes. And also, when we were considering different variation, different alternatives, one of the arguments for this type of training was that it is vine is, what's the word in English? It's a vine, you know, basically, the original vine, it was a parasite that was climbing on the trees, that it was using the trunks of the trees to climb up and get the sunshine from above the trees. So it's a natural shape for the vine to grow these long, long shoots and not to be bound in any part, any type of wiring or whatever. So we chose to plant most of our new vineyards is planted as a cordon, including the Pinot, and that's an interesting thing because most of the Pinot that we are aware of is usually on the Guyot type of training,
right.
And it's always a big discussion when we are talking to old and experienced wine growers. For instance, everybody was saying that the cordon is not good because it's far away from the roots, and that the plants will be the grapes will be mellow and have a lot of acidity, not enough sugar. But that's not our experience. So it's one of but it depends always on the microclimate. Anyway,
Is 100% Pinot Noir.
This is 100% Pinot Noir, and
you've all had Slovakian Pinot Noirs up until today, right?
And Pinot Noir is one of the grapes that may not sound so traditionally, although it has been grown in Slovakia and our region for hundreds of years. Obviously, it's at home in Burgundy. But at the same time, for me, it is fascinating as a grape variety that is very versatile and can grow in all different places of the world. You in the U.S. know that. So we are really focusing on local grape varieties in our winery, but Pinot is, for me, great challenge because it's grown really all over the entire world, and it is like the ultimate grape. I love wines from Pinot Noir, and I always felt I wanted to make our take on the grape, the Slovakian interpretation of the variety, because it's one of the noblest grapes I know. And there is a special vineyard, special plot that I was trying to buy out for a couple of years from many owners. And ever since I focused my attention on it, it's a beautiful southwestern slope where more than 30 years, nothing was farmed. It was just grown with some wild plants, and horses were grazing there, so it was a really beautifully rested soil. And from the very, very beginning, it felt like it's a place that requires Pinot. It's kind of hard to explain.
It was untreated with anything?
No. For the couple of decades, it was not treated with anything. And we planted this vineyard that you taste wine from now in 2017. This wine is its first harvest, and it's a very special vineyard for us, mainly because of the procedure, the thought procedure, and that we went through before planting it, and because of the plants that are in that vineyard. You know, when we planted our first vineyard, that was exactly 10 years before that, in 2007, we planted Frankovka. The thought process there was to choose a correct grape. We were thinking in terms of grape varieties, and when we decided it will be Frankovka, it was my dad who did all the thinking. I was not really involved in anything at that time, and my dad did an incredible choice to pick up exactly this grape. We'll talk about Frankovka later. He just went to a supplier of little plants for plantation, and he bought Frankovka. Yeah, it was supposed to be a good one. So we ordered, I don't know, 3,870 plants that are in the plot, and we planted it. And we cared for the vineyard best we could. We'll taste it later. However,
but can we tell everyone now that Frankovka is also
Blaufränkisch? Blaufränkisch. We'll talk about
so
that too.
You know, it's the Slovakian version
name of Blaufränkisch. Yeah. Going back to the Pinot, we knew the grape will be Pinot. However, we wanted to plant it properly. So we started to read the books. I read there are some clones of Pinot, which is the first time I was actually introduced to the concept of the clones. We have read that there are some beautiful Pinot clones from Dijon that have been selected in 1960s, and that these have very good properties, and it's good to combine several of them to make a good vineyard. And then we started to visit some winemakers working with Pinot in Slovakia, in Czech Republic, and later on in Burgundy. In Slovakia and Czech Republic, it turned out that almost all of the Pinot that was planted currently is two clones, 777 and 115. So we thought that, like, okay, that's the way to go, apparently. And then I came to Burgundy, and because of the beauty of the natural wine community of winemakers, we were able to meet some of very good Burgundy winemakers, including Thibault Ligeat-Baler in Nuits Saint-Georges and Julien Juliot in Maconville. And meeting these guys very shortly after acquiring the knowledge of the existence of clones, we discovered that this is actually shunned by the traditional natural winemakers over there, because they were realizing, after the experience they already had with the clones, which was later to be explained to us by the pépiniérist, the guy who was working with the plantation material, is that problem of the clones is that it's genetically identical individuals that you plant. And they have been selected in those 1960s when the agriculture was completely crazy in terms of controlling everything and the kind of industrially approaching the agriculture by the engineers in France, in Bonn, they selected the best versions of the grape to have good yields, good sugar, good flavor profile, good everything. So if you look at the 777 or 115, it's amazing grape, but it's a problem if you plant the entire vineyard with this, because it becomes plain. That's what they experienced. You know, all the old vineyards, they are very diverse. They have individuality. There is hundreds of distinctive plants that originated through the hundreds of years of evolution, and each of that plant individually is probably nowhere near as good as the clone in terms of all the important key performance indicator, you know? But each has its unique contribution to the entire mix and is different in every year. So some can perform better in a hot year, and some can be good in the wet year. And together they create a unique expression of given vineyard and given vintage. So what we came to understand is that when you truly want to have a wine that is rich in its expression, that is full of flavor and concentrated, you should be looking for the diversity of the plants, which is what the clones bring to the, which is what the old Massal selections bring to the table. And I don't want to go through the entire story, but we ended up with a very interesting Massal selection that is essentially a genetic replica of 100 years old vineyard based in Pomard, Clos des Epineaux, farmed by Comte Armand. And we are working with a pépiniérist who is keeping the heritage of that vineyard alive for them, for replanting new plants. And it's vastly massive Massal selection. There is more than 400 unique plants in the selection, and that's what we planted in our Valley of the Wolf, in our village. So I was really, really excited to wait for the first harvest, because there was a very bold hypothesis with the expectation of that vineyard, which we've been talking about with the pepiniarist. And the idea is that we all revere the wines from the old vines, you know, like wines from the very old vineyards. And I have always thought, and all the people I have spoken about it also, that the beauty of the wines from the old vines is from the deep roots, from the age of the plant that has been settled in the place for decades, and it's stable, and it has reasonable yields, and it creates these concentrated grapes full of flavor, which of course is a part of the story. But it turns out that most likely the second part of the story is that if you realize old vines, by law, it's 70 plus years. If we have 2020 more or less now, so it gets us to about 1950 as the youngest old vines available. It's the time before the cloves were started to be massively planted in the vineyards. It's from the times when just the vineyard was nourished as an individuality, and it has been replaced by those many different plants that were growing in the vineyard. So the hypothesis is that when you are planting very diverse mast cell selection, you are actually getting part of the richness of the old vines also in the young vineyard, not because the vines are really young, so the taste is not big. But for instance, if you taste this Pinot, it's so rich in the flavor already. It's a, you know, it's a baby vineyard. It's the first harvest, but the flavor is super super rich, and so we are so excited about where the vineyard will take us in the future years.
So, we tried the first two wines. Any questions? Because we're going to move to the second two wines, which will be our four wines. Any questions about the first wines? Any questions in general?
Yes. Also, there is one funny story I wanted to mention, very short. I told you we are on a hill between Valley of the Rose and Valley of the Wolves. But if you notice the bottle of Pinot, which is in the Valley of the Wolves, the name on the bottle is Teufelstal Pinot, which is the old German name of the valley. And it does not mean Valley of the Wolves, in fact, the way how it is called in Slovak now. It means the Valley of the Devil. So it's just crazy, you know. I've been always fascinated by the power of the names of those places, and by the contrast that... If I look all the vineyards in our farm, if I stand on the roof of my winery, which we did in such a way that we can go up there because it's a beautiful view of a wide surrounding, but all the vineyards are within 400 meter diameter from that place. So it's all very close to each other, and it always really gets to me that when I look one way, it's the Valley of the Rose, and you can feel the place is gentle in a way. And on the other side, you have the Valley of the Devil, and it's such a great contrast. And it's hard to explain, but it feels very, very powerful to be in between of those two. So I just wanted to share that.
All right. So, do we have the third wine in front of everyone, or almost? We can talk about that. But before you talk about that, you mentioned someone earlier. I mean, I guess it's fair to say you've been instrumental in the Slovakian natural wine movement. You talked about some of your influences. You talked about Strekov, you know, early on. I mean, anyone else, any other influences, mentors, you know, that have shaped?
Yeah, absolutely. This was, it's a broader topic, actually. My first contact with natural wine was with Streko, and then we met a couple of other winemakers. But I'm very happy to be here at RO doing this talk, because my most eye-opening experience, and actually the experience that also gave me the contacts to get to Burgundy, was a RO fair, the only RO fair that took place in Vienna in 2004. I'm not sure if it was 13 or 14. And we have discovered the first wines made without addition of sulfites there. And that was like beautiful, beautiful thing. And I have asked every winemaker whose wines I liked. I was asking, that's also where we came to know the biodynamic wines, which was not known to us at that time or very vaguely. I was asking them where they learned to do what they do. And iconic winemakers, like I remember now, it was Eduard Czepe from Gutogau. And he said, well, from the other winemakers, you know, that it was, especially Austria is really inspiring in this, and we've been trying to do that in Slovakia too, that the people talk together, they share, they learn from each other, and that's how the knowledge is shared and created. And in Slovakia, I don't know exactly, but we are somewhere 15 to 20 winemakers making natural wines. I tried to calculate once the production. So it's, I think, slightly less than 1% of the entire wine market of our country. So it's a tiny thing. And more than, I think 80% of that wine is being exported. So. Even though Slovakia drinks a lot more wine than it produces.
That's interesting.
And we have
Two important wines, these two right here, right?
Absolutely. But just to finish your question, because I want to mention our group called Autentista that was established in the south of Slovakia in the village of Streko, which was more or less a place where the most of the natural movement started at the beginning, especially connected with Streko 1075 and also a gentleman called Stefan Kasznik, but he's less than 1 hectare of production making very... But he was the one on the Rofer in Vienna. He was the only from Slovakia at Rofer at that time. And so it was established in Streko, and now we are 5 members. So it's Streko 1075, Kasniak and Matias, wineries from southern Slovakia, Slobodne, and us from Malokarpatska. And maybe to touch a little bit on that before we proceed to the wines, I realized Slobodne and us, we are the kind of younger generation or a different generation, because the wineries in Streko, those are people who grew up in the vineyards or in the environment that was making wines. It was a part of their upbringing, part of their culture. But for myself or people from Slobodne, it's a completely different story. We have grown up in Bratislava. We're the same generation, slightly above 40. I studied business administration and finance in Slobodna. They studied economics and law. So we just grew up in
everything but wine.
Everything but wine, exactly. And not in my wildest dreams did I intend to become a farmer or become a winemaker. Even at that 2005 meeting that we discussed planting the vineyard with my parents, I did not really realize what's going on and what's start. I just liked the idea of having a winery and vineyard, but I never imagined myself what it means. I mean, it's a crazy story since then. So I just wanted to touch on that we there are people in Slovakia who are from the natural continuous wine growing environment, and there is a generation like myself who came to it from completely different environments, and we just got...
So that, just to spell it out, because I do that a lot, that group, it's called Autentista, Autentista, and that's Vladimir and the five other guys that are trying to get natural wines, you know, more accepted in Slovakia and beyond.
Yeah, and to share the knowledge among ourselves,
right,
too.
Right. You guys are very generous towards each other with that. All right, let's talk about the fourth wine, the Frankovka, which is Blaufränkisch.
Blaufränkisch, yeah. I'm encouraging everybody who is not from a German-speaking country to consider using the term Frankovka, because I just like the name so much in Slovak. But the grape we are speaking about is the most important grape from Central Eastern Europe, speaking about blue grapes, of course. It is instrumental to understanding our wines, whether it is Austria, Hungary, Slovakia, Czech Republic. Frankovka has the wonderful ability to reflect soil, to reflect microterroir, so it can be extremely diverse among other wine among different places. At the same time, what I find, especially in our vineyard, is that even in very difficult vintages, it is able to produce beautiful grapes that create wonderful wines, although, of course, they reflect the year, but the wines, with when given enough time, they sometimes carry more attraction than, you know, like the conventionally good years. I want to talk a little bit about the vineyard itself, because...
Of this particular wine?
Of this particular
so this
wine.
Is a 2017 vintage, right?
Yes.
This has a little bottle age.
It has. It needs to have. That's what I find with Frankovka. It's possible to make a very good rosé of Frankovka. It's possible to make a very fruity and energetic younger red. But the way I like to work with the grape is to make actually well-matured red wines that have been given enough time to age in the cellar as well as in the bottle. That's why we have the 2017 vintage, which until very recently was our current vintage. I'm introducing the 2018 this week, more or less. We don't even have the labels for 2018. When I go back to the vineyard, I told you it was my dad who did all the thought process for choosing the right grape, and there were some crazy ideas I can tell you about planting all different sorts of grapes and combination of different grape varieties together. But somehow he ended up choosing this most... Looking back, it looks like a no-brainer, but it was not. It was a difficult thinking. The vineyard has a very special place in the lives and hearts of my family, because that is the vineyard that actually connects us with our ancestors. That is the vineyard that was planted by my great-grandfather, who, by the way, did not grow up in winemaking environment. He was from northern Slovakia, married to Trnava, was a director of insurance company, health insurance company, and just fell in love with making wine at the peak of his career, bought the plot, bought the house, and planted a vineyard that was very modern at that time. So in many respects, we are kind of looking back to him that his life was similar to what our family is experiencing now. And it was on this plot that was taken away from our family, and then after 40-something years was returned, wow, that we started, that we decided to become farmers again, that we started to establish the winery. And... for me personally, it's even more important. We call this vineyard by the name of my first son, Hugo, because at the
What's
time...
What's that? Spell it?
H-U-G-O.
Hugo.
G-O.
Yeah, Hugo. Okay.
Which, by the way, means full of spirit as a meaning of a name. I love that name. I didn't want to be called Hugo until I found out the meaning of the name. It was my wife's crazy idea. we planted the vineyard when we were expecting, and he was born exactly at the time when the young shoots were going out from the earth. So it's a very, very personal vineyard to us. And somehow I think it's also because of that the wines are very special when we make them. It was the first time making wine from this vineyard that I felt as a winemaker. Twice, actually. Once in 2011, when we had the first proper harvest from the vineyard, and I tasted the wine, which was still on skins, with my dad. It's a very rare moment I remember as a personal experience, that I was in the cellar with my dad and we just tasted the wine. It's actually, yeah, it's it's touching to remember. It's funny. We just tasted it and looked at each other, and we knew it's amazing. It's I'm surprised by the emotion that is overwhelming. It's a great memory. Sorry about that.
It's a very special wine.
And second time, this vineyard and the grapes from this vineyard became so important for me personally was in the vintage 2012, because like I said, I studied business administration and finance, so I knew nothing at all about agriculture or making wine. My dad, he did wine when he was like 20 years old, once or twice with his aunt. That was the extent of his experience. And the most experienced person in the family was my mother, who studied chemistry and was into environmental protection all of her life. But her first professional experience in early 1980s was that she worked in a brewery. So she knew something about fermentation. And she's also a very diligent student of things. So, whereas I am not so keen to read books, especially the factual books, my mom she used to work in Geneva at that time in the UN. So she was alone and she read all the books there were about making wine, and she was the one designing the processes in the cellar for the first few years. And basically, I was just the muscle, especially the first two vintages. And then in 2012, that was a very profound year for me as a person, as a winemaker. It was the time when the winemakers of Strecko 1075 separated. And my mentor, Tibor, who unfortunately passed away last year, he was the winemaker who started his own winery at that time. And when I found out that his schedule is a little more free than it used to be, I asked him to consult and to work with me on the 2012 vintage. So he was coming every week, and we've been working together in the cellar. So that was...
When he came... Were there drastic changes, or were they subtle?
No, not really.
I mean, you were on the right track.
Yeah.
Okay.
He was my primary inspiration for winemaking from the beginning, and even the processes that my mom designed, they were not from the place of natural wine philosophy, but they were from the place of fine wine, French fine wine, like the top appellation winemaking style philosophy. So the differences were actually not so huge.
Right.
And the extent of intervention was very small already. But with the 2012, it was when I did my first wine according to myself, which was Frankovka Unplugged, by the way, the style of wine we have in the second. Now, please, let's focus on the wines. You have two glasses ahead of you. They are from the vineyard I was talking so much about. And the grapes are important. However, these two wines, they are very good example to show that even if you are making wine in a natural way and you have the same raw material, because these two wines are from literally same raw material coming to the cellar, you can produce vastly different wines with slight variation in the winemaking process. So the first one, I don't know which is left and which is right. You need to figure that out for yourself. But
I think the first is left.
You'll figure that out very soon when tasting the wines. The one is classic Frankovka, which means when the grapes come to the cellar, they are crushed. The wine then goes down to crushed and destemmed. The wine goes to the open vats, stays on skins for 6 weeks. We are manually punching it down. And then the wine, it's a free run, actually. It's not pressed. Either of them is not pressed. Then it's gravitationally racked to the barrels, stay there for 2 years with fine lees, and then it's bottled, treated with 10 milligrams of sulfur just before bottling. So, very simple and conservative process. The second wine is from exactly same grapes. So I'm just choosing part of each which is going through the crusher, and part of it I'm crushing by feet, and it ferments with stems. The thing is, I'm calling this wine unplugged because there is no machine involved in any part of the winemaking process. So it's the gentlest possible way of transforming the grape into the wine. It spends equal amount of time on skins. It spends equal amount of time in the barrels. And then is gravitationally bottled. It is treated with the same amount of sulfur too. So the process is very, very similar. But if you taste the wine, the sophistication, the depth, the breadth, the deepness of the wine, the depth of the wine is completely elsewhere, and it's easy to recognize. One is softer, gentler. You know, the unplugged is a little more difficult to interpret at the first. It has certain distance, but then when you start to talk to it, it opens up a little. And it's my most favorite wine. It's a wine that I love to drink when I have the opportunity. I don't have so much of it, so it's not an everyday wine even for us. But that's also a big lecture of how very subtle variation in the process can impact the wine. And it also tells you that many things, you know, because when we are talking about natural wine, sometimes it feels very esoteric and very, you never know what's the story and what's the substance. But there is actually a lot of substance. Even I'm doing many things in the cellar because I believe they are right. I have no factual knowledge of what's going on. But observing tiny differences like this is a fantastic confirmation that those beliefs that I intuitively feel, I feel it in my heart and I feel it in my head, they make sense to me, and the wine confirms that those beliefs are correct. And that's very important for me, and that's what I like to explore. I mean, we could talk about intuitive responses to crisis and what beautiful things can come out of that, especially. We don't have time for a story.
We're running out of time, but we do have... I'm not going to deny you this story, but we got to wrap up soon.
Yeah. I will tell you all the stories in my stand if you like to come at number 15, because I have three wines that are called Vlk, Wolf, and all of them are a product of a crisis. Oranžový Vlk... I came familiar with orange wines some 10 years ago, and I really liked them. We didn't do anything like that. At some point, I felt I wanted to explore that style of winemaking, which was in 2015. And I have observed from other winemakers that a very good grape for making skin fermented white is Welsh Riesling, Riesling Italico, famous local grape. So I decided we have a beautiful old vineyard with Riesling Italico. So part of the grapes, I said we are going to use it for one barrel of orange. I calculated the amount, I put it into the vat, it fermented beautifully, everything was perfect until I racked the wine to the barrel and discovered that the barrel is filled to 70% and I don't have any orange to fill it to the top. And that didn't feel so good. And for a moment, I didn't know what to do. However, you need to find a solution because that's your job. So I was thinking, and you know, if you look at our portfolio, we don't have many white grapes. It's a scarce grape for us, white grape. So I had a little amount of a grape called Devín, which is a special Slovak grape, and a little amount of Grüneveltliner as white grapes without any skin contact, young wines already. And I was thinking, okay, I need to top up the barrel, and I ended up filling half of the empty space by Grüneveltliner and the other half of the space by Devín, because I didn't want to quote-unquote waste too much of each of them because I didn't have enough of the white wines. And what was really not motivated by creation of the blend, but by solving a problematic situation in the cellar, ended up as being a brilliant blending decision, not decision, a blending result. It was not a decision.
No, it was brilliant afterwards.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And ever since then, I was always combining these three grapes. I have replaced Dziewin for the first time with Gewurztraminer in the 2020, because Dziewin is also aromatic, and I always want to have 20 to 25% of aromatic grape in the blend. I find it really charming. And otherwise, the Grüner Veltliner and Welsh Riesling are the core of the wine. So that was the story of Oranžový vlk, and it was supposed to be Riesling Vlašský Orange, you know? It was not supposed
Interesting.
To be a blend.
All right, we have to wrap up soon. The last couple of wines we tried, does anyone have any questions? Any observations, questions? All right. We've taken advantage of our time. I want to thank our guest, Vladimir Magula.
Thank you.
Keep an eye out for Vladimir's wines, Magula Family Winery Estate. Like Vladimir said, some of these wines go back to 2017. He has current vintages. So thank you to Vladimir. Thank you guys for coming in to Raw Wine and spending time at the Speaker's Corner. I'm Sam Ben Ruby from the Grape Nation podcast on the Heritage Radio Network. Please listen anytime. This week we have Isabel Legere on, who comes on every year. Raw Wine is here in New York. It's a great interview with perspective about raw wine, the winemakers, you know, everything she does. So thank you again for coming out. Enjoy the rest of the day, and go visit Vladimir.
Thank you, and see you there. Enjoy the fair.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.